welcome to Season 3, Episode 15 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. Today's episode is part two of our final series focused on Justin's dissertation. In today's episode, we discuss Ephesians 2 and Ephesians 5 from an imperial critical perspective. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week. So what are you doing for coffee here?
Simple. I have got a Caribou cold press simply because I had to grab it on my way in today. So that was, again, a matter of convenience. So now you look like you're not even drinking coffee. Is that ice cream that you're eating?
That is ice cream. Yeah.
It reminds me of, like, it looks to me like you have that wooden spoon that they have like in the old malt cups that you'd get like at sports games, you know, at the baseball games.
You got it.
Is it a malt cup?
That's very much what's going on here. It's a little cup from a place called Eisspatz, which is like ice cream sparrow.
Oh, nice. Eisspatz. Oh, that's great. Well, I it's a little early for me for ice cream, although, you know, I'm not sure that there's technically any ice cream that's too early for anything in life, but
no, I was hoping it would be a coffee ice cream so I could say that was my coffee, but it turns out it's a mint chocolate chip and I'm not sad about that.
What did you do for coffee today? Anything unusual?
I think I've had 3 cups of coffee today, which isn't terrible because I woke up so tired. So the reason I have ice cream is because it's a kid's first day of school.
Yeah.
And so a whole group of us walked down to the ice cream place and it took a lot longer than I was hoping. And so I ended up leaving and then here about 30 minutes later, the ice cream got to me, but I appreciate it. Yeah. So, but coffee, I did French press this morning and then a couple cups, little cups here at the office. So not a whole lot of coffee compared to how tired I was. But the reason I'm tired is because we were up way earlier than normal.
Yeah.
Because of the kids going to school. Although a listener did reach out to me and let me know that my definition of too early in the morning did not match reality, that apparently I get up too late.
So. What time do you usually get up at?
I don't know, like 7-ish.
That's too late. Wow.
So, but today we were up closer to 6-ish. So I don't think that's even true. I think it was 6:30, but it felt like 6, but anything before 7, but you know, I mean, we're coming off a summer schedule. And so we've been sleeping in more.
This listener isn't your brother-in-law, Levi, is it? Because I imagine he gets up at like 4 o'clock in the morning and that's no, not usual. Not so
no, it actually happens to be a listener who I happen to know used to sleep until 11. So
tell Marcus he's getting up too early. Well, do you have a highlight then for this past week?
I do have a highlight. Okay. So like maybe a month ago we were talking, whenever the last time we were recording was, and we got to talking about a bike,
an e-bike,
and I bought the e-bike and I love it.
Nice. I'm so excited. We have the same bike. I think the exact same bike. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I think the difference is you've got a different handlebar stem.
Yeah.
And I've got one coming in the mail.
Nice.
And for whatever reason, our LED lights are different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's right.
I don't know why that's something that's different across the ocean. But anyway, I love this bike.
Well, I was going to ask quickly from the time that you bought it online to the time it arrived, how long did it take to ship to you?
It took, once they actually shipped it, it was very quick. But it seemed like maybe my order didn't get noticed right away or something. So I reached out to them and the only issue was I was leaving town for a couple of days. So I was like, hey, you know, is it coming? And then they wrote back and they're like, thank you for your patience. It'll be there shortly. And then it was there. I got there while I was out of town, which was a little unfortunate.
Oh, bummer.
So, well, it's all right. I had a neighbor that came in and let them in. You know, it's not a small box.
It's and the biggest box I've ever received in the mail. That's for sure.
Yeah. So I'm really conflicted on what to do. This kind of diverges from the highlight, but here in Germany, you save the boxes for everything in case you need to return it. And I'm like, I don't know about this box, man. It is so big, but I love this bike. I've been riding it for, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 days now. And I've already got over 50 miles on it, which compared to what I was riding before
is
a lot. I know for people who are avid bikers, that's probably not much, but for me. It's a lot, and it's super practical for me. I've got, you know, saddlebags for it, and then I've also got a trailer for it. And so I've been using it to run all these errands because I don't have a car.
Yeah.
And actually with this bike and with the trailer, I feel like I don't, like the use cases for having my own car goes down between that bike. And then of course we've got great public transit here. So I still, there's still some reasons why I think I should get my license, and where it'd be helpful to be able to, you know, occasionally you need to move something bigger than what you can do on the bike. But I'm really enjoying it. Yesterday I rode it, whatever 11 kilometers is, over to my son's baseball game and then back. And yeah, it was just nice. And the battery lasts great. Like, even though I've been on some long rides, I haven't even ticked down the first bar of battery yet. So,
yeah, the reason I even looked at it is because I have a friend who got an e-bike, and I was just telling him, you know, hey, I'm considering getting one. And he says, well, this is the one I would have gotten if I would have. He bought his, he bought his like locally from somebody who was just selling their old e-bike. And he's like, if I would have bought one new, this is the one I would have gotten. And he told me all the reasons why. So I'm like, well, I better take a look at this one. So, and one of the reasons why is because of the battery life and how long it lasts, you know, without needing to charge it. So no, that's super cool.
With the battery life and then the weight capacity and the fact that I, you know, the payload capacity that I can tow stuff and not feel like I'm stressing the motor. So
yeah. And now what's the ice situation like there in the wintertime?
I mean, we get a little bit of snow, but it's nothing. I mean, it's completely not comparable with Minnesota.
So you might
be totally different.
Yeah, situation. You might be able to just use those tires and ride in the wintertime then. Like
And one thing that's great about those fat tires here is we've got a lot of cobblestone roads.
Yeah.
And so I just feel a lot more secure with a big tire, and I don't feel like I'm at risk of, you know, banging up the frame
or
banging spokes going over some of those things. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. How about for you? What's a highlight, Ben? By the way, thanks for the recommendation.
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't know everything there's to know about e-bikes by any means, but I was happy with my selection. So I'm glad that you are too.
Yeah.
For us, well, we're back in the swing of things here in the academic year. And as you recall from your time doing this for a long time, we always have like about 3, 4, or 5 days worth of meetings, faculty meetings and all faculty staff meetings.
I definitely remember those.
Yeah. And you know, it's a stressful time of year because like everybody is coming to the realization that, wow, the summer came to a close a lot quicker than you always think it will. And that there's stuff to do.
Every year. Yeah.
You always have these ambitions as a professor, like, oh yeah, you know, when May rolls around, I got all this, I'm going to get done early. And it never seems to really work that way. But so those meetings can be a little stressful in that everyone kind of has this lingering, you know, stuff to get done hanging over them. But this particular year here, our VP of Academic Affairs wanted our department to do some presentations on the Trinity to get the faculty thinking a bit about the character of God kind of moving into the semester. So they assigned me the task of talking about Jesus, about God the Son. So so I had an opportunity to give a presentation on that. And it was probably one of the more like interesting faculty meetings I've ever been a part of. And I can't say it was necessarily due to me, but I highlighted a couple of different things about Jesus that I think were unusual places to go. And man, people really opened up. Like, we were having a very personal and very interesting conversation about the implications of these passages for us in the ministry we do at Crown, but also just in our personal lives. And we got to the point even where I turned to the VP of Academic Affairs, and we even just kind of talked about what a Crown prof do if they were struggling and whatnot. And it was unique, I'll say that nonetheless. Like,
sounds really encouraging.
It was something that I never experienced in the academic workplace. And again, I don't want to take any credit for it, because I can't say that it was my doing, but it was just it was refreshing. I was excited to be able to present, but I think where it went, I could have never imagined the conversation it generated. And I was really excited about what happened. So that was encouraging. And there, my colleagues who presented on God the Father and God the Spirit, they did a fantastic job as well. So I think this just 3 days of series of reflections was very unique and something I was really glad that our administrator had decided to go with. So I was encouraged by it.
Yeah, that's really exciting. That seems like a really good place to start the school year.
Yeah.
At a place like Crown to stop and say, okay, why are we...
Yep.
why are we here? Like, yeah. And I've been thinking some about the character of God and how we represent the character of God and that as a foundation for what we do.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's.
Yeah. And I think that was where our administrator was taking it, you know, wanting to start the year. And, you know, you've been a part of these before, I think too, at a Christian institution, you know, we have devotionals sometimes for things or little, mm-hmm. you know, little comments and, you know, they can be good. They can always be good, I think, but this was very, intentional in terms of the kind of topics I think that that our VP was selecting. So it was very interesting and energizing. So I was excited about it.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear that. What's a low light for you?
Man, I think with this time of year and academics coming up and everything being quite wild and crazy, I've been taking my sons to school and picking them up from school, well, daycare, for the whole mm-hmm. summer. So I get the car ride with them and I get the car ride back home. And I can't say that those car rides are always extremely exciting, especially sometimes when I pick them up, you know, they're not always in the greatest mood. Sometimes we have to wake them up from their nap time to get them out. And that's, as you probably recall, that's, man, waking the kids up from nap time, that's never their best time of day. However, I am realizing now, like with me getting back in the academic schedule, like I don't think I'm gonna be able to pick them up or bring them to school or pick them up here for the next few weeks. And then once the semester starts, it'll get more complicated. So yeah, I kind of miss having some of that time with my boys. And my oldest is going off to kindergarten. So big change there for us
this
too.
Year.
Yeah, this year he's going to be kindergarten. And so it was a really crazy thought for us. And the idea that, hey, my two sons won't be in school together or won't be going to the same mm-hmm. place for another like 3 years now.
And this is on top of a change that, because you had been just right across the street, for daycare for a long time. And then you switched within the last 6 months.
Yeah, anyway, right? Exactly. Yep. But it's, and they've always gone to the same location always, since my youngest was born. So that'll be interesting change for us. I think, you know, nothing profoundly, you know, negative in terms of my low light, but just some thoughts I've been having about missing
some more. Loss
yeah.
There,
yeah.
Some loss. That's, yeah.
Yep. How about for you? What's the low light been?
So on Thursday night we had a really significant, thunderstorm come through, which on the one hand was great because we've been so, so dry. Like we've got, I mean, they're showing pictures of World War II battleships emerging from the rivers, like because the rivers are so far down and we're seeing these across Europe. I mean, it's just, and then there was this, I don't think they've figured out exactly what caused it yet, but there was a massive fish die-off in a river in Poland that comes into Germany. And anyway, it seems like maybe the lack of water was connected to that. And they're talking about limitations on barge traffic and all this kind of stuff, right? So like we've just been so dry. And so rain was great. But we had this thunderstorm come through and it woke us all up in the middle of the night and just this massive boom, you know, like great, great big thunderclap. And woke us up about 3 and it was just... So it must have been, I don't know. There's a lightning rod across the street on top of one of the buildings. I think it must have been there. It was so loud and it took all of us about an hour to get back to sleep. And I didn't sleep super well. And that in and of itself would be fine. But the next day was Jenny's birthday. And so I was like trying to be really present, you know, for her birthday and to be very thoughtful of her. And I was so tired. And I just like the feeling of the inability to really honor her well on her birthday because I was so tired was my low light for
that's week, that's hard. So. Yeah. I don't know. Do you ever find yourself, I feel like there are times where if I have a night like that, I'll wake up super tired. And sometimes I can kind of generate enough, just adrenaline or something to get going throughout the day. And then for me, I'll just hit a point and it'll just crash. It'll just come down on me like a ton of bricks. And it's like, you can't even hardly keep your eyes open at that point.
So I had a meeting that morning. And so I was about, I don't know, 3 hours or so at this meeting. And at the meeting, I had, you know, plenty of energy, I thought, and then got to the end of it. And then I was just done for the day.
Man.
So yeah.
Dang.
Yeah. And then I don't know about you, for you, but for me, it also usually carries on to the next day.
Yeah.
And so, yes. So then the following day I was also exhausted, but that was okay. Cause I wasn't trying to, you know, be Well, I guess I was still trying to honor Debbie, but I wasn't trying to, like, you know, make this the day special unusually for her. So
what's your insight in there? Is there an insight somewhere else you'd like to go?
I do have an insight. Yeah. So this morning we started back into a pattern of prayer with a partner ministry here in town. And we meet 3 days a week for about 30 minutes of prayer. And there's a portion of it that is more, I've got all the wrong words coming to mind. Liturgical. Yeah. There's a portion of it that's more liturgical. And then there's a portion of it that's more kind of open prayer. And then we go back to a liturgical closing. And we had done it for the whole last school year. And then we took a break here for, I don't know, maybe a month and a half or 2 months over the summer. And started up today. Today was the first day back. And I just really, it felt good to get back into that, which is interesting to me. Nice. I'm not great with routine. Like, I just, in general, routine is not, it's not a strong suit for me. So this, I mean, probably this prayer thing is one of the most routine things I've done in my adult life, maybe other than going to class, you know, to teach. But yeah. And I think it was good. And I remembered, like, the words just have, I remember C.S. Lewis talking about liturgy kind of being or reading somewhere that he had talked about liturgy as kind of being this place where it almost gave his mind space to rest so that he could commune with God, because he didn't have to think about what he was going to say or whatever. You know, he could just be present and let the liturgy carry him along in prayer. And so I felt that, and then also the goodness of praying with others. So yeah, that was good. So the insight that could have been a highlight, I guess, but the insight was just the goodness of doing these remembering patterns together.
Yeah.
And I think in a way it connects also with your highlight of, you know, reminding each other, why are we doing what we're doing? And, you know, what is the foundation of what we're doing? And just that there's goodness in that.
That's great. Yes.
How about for you?
Actually not now. I've got a related thought that maybe I'll just take and run with a bit. You're talking about this liturgy of prayer, and something that we've been doing with our church here is a Bible reading, like a read the Bible in a year plan. I can't remember if I already mentioned this on the podcast, but there's a couple of things that stand out to me about this as it relates to what you were saying. And the first is that I was a little bit surprised. We started at Genesis, as is the case a lot of times, and started working our way through, and we're up to Judges in our scriptural reading. And I think I'm a little, there's some difficult passages in the Pentateuch, in the first, you know, the first five books of the Hebrew scriptures. I think that sometimes when people are going through difficult phases of questioning their faith, sometimes it's easy to kind of just give it as a platitude to say, well, you should go back to reading your scriptures a little more carefully or something. But I don't want to be dismissive of people whose faith trials or even struggles may be the result of their Bible reading rather than a result of having somehow left reading the Bible. In other words, like, I mean, there are some of these passages I haven't revisited for a long time. Like, I couldn't tell you how old I was the last time I looked at some of these passages. Mm-hmm. And so now reading it through the lens of the person I am now, I can see some of the difficult passages. So that's one thing that stood out to me. I don't know if there's an insight there other than I'm sympathetic to folks who are really wrestling through what to do with some of these things. But I'm also, I think the insight that I'm getting at is I'm also realizing how the way that we've been taught to read the scriptures, I think, can also be very unhelpful in this process of answering some of the questions about what to do with these passages. So just today we're in Judges, and there's a story of this guy named Jephthah. Do you remember the story of him and his daughter? It's okay if you don't.
Oh man, it rings a bell, but I don't know if I could tell it off the top of my head.
So the guy's like having conflict with these other folks in the land, and he basically makes a vow to the Lord saying that, hey, if you remember this?
Yeah. This is terrible.
Yeah, it's absolutely awful, right? The vow is if you hand these people over to me, I will make a human sacrifice of the first person that I see back at my house.
What are you thinking? Anyway,
Exactly. So anyhow, what happens? He goes and wins the battle, and then he comes home, and the first person he sees is his daughter, his only child, and he's just in utter agony. You know, Lord, why? And that he feels this need to keep the vow, and even the daughter kind of says, "Yeah, you should keep your vow," and she considers herself almost as like sacrifice or something. The reason I bring
and
up then, this,
and but she asks for time to go and spend time with her friends to mourn the loss of
Yep. And then she's, and there's not much detail about it, but then apparently she was sacrificed, and that's the end of her. The reason why I think about this passage today and as it relates to thinking about these habits and how this can create some questions for us is because it's very interesting that like, there's really no criticism of Jephthah's actions and Judges. So I think the problem is if we take this at face value,
it's missing, right?
It feels like it's missing.
Is it implicitly there, or is it, or am I bringing that as the outside reader? Yeah,
it is implicitly there.
Yeah. I read it within the last year or two, and yeah, I remember those feelings of great discomfort.
Yeah, and if all you have are Judges, the book of Judges, and you have no understanding of where Israel's at in that period of their history and what this is coming off of and their entrance into the land and the covenant that God makes with them on Sinai, this story might even sound like God is somehow giving stamp of approval on these actions. But hermeneutically speaking, this is not getting too thick in the weeds. There's plenty of reason to suggest that Jephthah's actions are by no means acceptable. And in fact, it is the criticism. There's no way, there's no conceptualization within Israel that humans should be sacrificed, especially after
No, because that's part of what Israel was supposed to undo, right?
Exactly. So what it made me think of is, what does the Bible say there? Well, the Bible says that this person made a vow to God, kept their vow, and it makes it seem almost as if that's an appropriate thing to do. But what the Bible doesn't say is what it means. What I mean is what the Bible isn't explicit about in this particular passage is exactly what this means. And I think what it's meant as is a deep criticism.
Right, because it goes to that question of, okay, well, what is the Bible doing here? Right.
Yeah.
What is the text doing? And the text is, it could be understood that the text is giving an example of how far off track the people had gotten at that point, right?
Exactly. So I think it cautions me sometimes when we see some of the actions of things that happen in scripture, or we get to these really rough passages, I think that can sometimes really shake our faith is to be a little cautious. This isn't just an easy solution, but to be cautious of wondering or thinking maybe a little bit about, is something in our interpretive paradigm causing us to make assumptions about this passage that maybe isn't really there. And that it might that be sort of fueling some of our questions in ways that, you know.
Yeah. Because I feel like sometimes we almost read it and then we like insert at the end of whatever passage we're reading, go and do likewise. That's not the right. Yeah. That's not a good hermeneutical approach.
Now, I'm not suggesting this is a magical solution. I mean, even in our faculty meetings, I mean, there's some concerns brought up as the presentation of God the Father was being made about what do you do about firstborn in Egypt, right? Who are killed, and what do you do about the commands and the conquests? And those are not easy questions.
No, so they're not.
I don't know what the insight is in here other than hey, we always have to kind of check and recheck our interpretive paradigms when we're approaching these texts. And that isn't to say that people who are going through really deep questions of faith and doubts about what these passages mean should be dismissed. But at the same time, just something to be thinking about, I guess.
Yeah. Bonus content and more at patreon.com/profsinrooms. We'll be back in a moment with the conversation about Ephesians 2 and Ephesians 5. Okay, so last episode we talked about Ephesians 1 and got kind of way into it. And I want to ask you about Ephesians 2, and we're not going to go through all nine of your passages. There's just no way. But I think trying to get kind of a rounded idea of what you were doing in your project here is super interesting. So could you maybe summarize the passage for us, Ephesians 2, 11 through 22?
So Ephesians 2 really depicts two groups who had previously been hostile towards one another, who are brought together in the Messiah, in Jesus. And the means by which Jesus brings that about is to remove the hostility between the two groups. It actually, the way it puts it is killing the hostility between the groups, and of the Messiah shedding his own blood for the sake of these two, breaking down some dividing wall of hostility that existed between them and making them at peace with one another.
And these two groups are the people, Israel, right? And the Gentiles, right? Are the two groups here?
Yeah. And again, that's some of the dispute and some of the hesitations of a supersessionist reading of this passage, which we talked about last time. Mm-hmm. But I would say that it seems pretty clear, because the way that those who were excluded from the group in this passage are described are is that they were seen as uncircumcised, they were seen as far off, they were seen as excluded from citizenship and to the people of Israel. So I think it's pretty safe to say that the depiction in Ephesians 2 is of the bringing together of Jews and Gentiles and the Messiah. This is what's going to lead Paul in Ephesians 3 to talk about the great mystery that was revealed to him, which is of that essentially that exact thing, the Jews and Gentiles as one unified people in the Messiah.
It's interesting too, because even on just a locutionary level, right? So the words themselves, there is something that feels, I mean, of course I'm reading it in English, so I don't know what it said in Greek. So I'll have to lean on you for that, but there's something that feels like a bit of a political statement in the same way that Philippians 3:20 does. And that's in verse 19. This is in the NIV. Consequently, you are no longer foreigners and strangers, but fellow citizens with God's people and also members of his household. And so there's yeah. more, it goes on there, but this citizenship language, which is also in Philippians 3:20, becomes to me something that strikes me as interesting in the context of looking at, you know, the imperial context or for us today, you know, what citizenship are we kind of most attached to?
Yeah. And Fred Long, who's an Ephesian scholar, he writes some on that, certainly from an imperial critical vantage point as well, on what implications this politeia, this idea of it being now having a new sort of citizenship and this new community might have for what Roman imperial community meant. I go a little different direction with it here in this passage, and because I'm mostly interested in the ways that the peace is depicted, how peace is brought about in Ephesians between two warring groups, two groups that were hostile towards each other.
This becomes interesting, keeping in mind that part of what you're doing is looking at the implied readers and saying, what would they have had in mind as they were reading this? What would the context have been for the implied reader? So the idea of peace and of the cessation of hostilities had a reference point, right? In the implied reader's world. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's quite a bit that's been written on Roman peace, on the Pax Romana, as we call it now, and thinking about the ways that Rome celebrated their way of establishing peace in the world. And there were these grandiose claims that were being made by Roman imperial ideology from the start of the empire, that Rome had brought about peace for the world. And a lot of times, I think in the 21st century, we think all that means is that Rome was celebrating that people were not warring with each other anymore. But it was much, much greater than that, because Roman peace wasn't just people shaking hands and saying, hey, let's all get along. A Roman peace was brought about through subjugation, through subjugating peoples.
So, and this was an imposed peace then?
It's an imposed peace. And Mary Beard, I think, says well in one of her documentary series, where she's looking at a particular altar that I actually also engage with here in my work, which celebrated peace. It's called the Altar of Peace. And you can go to Rome to this day and you can see the sort of reconstructed altar to peace that was originally built under Augustus. And she says, this isn't just an altar to peace. She says, it's really an altar to pacification. So they're celebrating and commemorating.
And pacification and pacifism are quite far apart, right?
Yeah, not pacifism, not the idea of the idea that we should refuse to fight, right, or have armed conflict, but pacification, which is the meaning of essentially forcing others under subjugation and then to become powerless in some ways and under the rule of another. So that's something that's a important theme. And I also look at this altar, even though we have to acknowledge that altar was built in the first century BC in Rome. And that raises important questions like, well, why would you bring this into the conversation when the people to whom this letter is being written to, they're not living in Rome. They're living far away. So what would they have known about this altar? This is where I don't really suggest anywhere that the recipients of Ephesians would have known this altar, but that it is one potent expression of what the Romans believed about how they brought peace. And that there's actually a whole region in the city of Rome to where most of the monuments were designed towards that. And we can confidently say that even if they hadn't known about the specific imagery of the altar, that the sort of emanation of the brand of Roman peace from Rome made its way out into the provinces in ways that would have been obvious and potent. So what I'm starting to wonder is you're a person, say, living in Asia Minor in either the mid first century or later, and you have familiarity with how Rome brings about peace. Mm-hmm. You then receive this letter and you hear these claims being made about Jesus's way of bringing about peace. How would you have heard that?
So maybe an example of this could be something like the Statue of Liberty, where so bringing it into our contemporary context, where people who maybe haven't ever seen the Statue of Liberty, or I mean, it's such an iconic image that it's kind of hard to imagine now that people haven't seen some representation of it. But there's this idea of the Statue of Liberty, the ideas that are kind of associated with it are powerful, whether or not you've ever been to the Statue of Liberty, and are powerful whether or not you really understand the statue itself, you know, when it was constructed, or, you know, the specific background of it. There's kind of this, I don't know, I want to say mythos that goes with it, that people could be either inspired by or, react to without ever having been, to the Eastern U.S.
It's kind of like this American conceptualization of liberty existed before the statue arrived on American soil. Right. So the statue could be seen as sort of an expression par excellence, maybe, of an American idea of liberty. And so that's, I think, the similar thing here. The Roman way of bringing about peace existed before this altar, but the altar sort of provides one great example of how all of that, or some of that, is captured in one monument. Mm-hmm. And so you don't need to know about the monument to know about the concepts, because the monument expresses concepts that were already existent.
Right. And the concepts don't require the monument, but the monument gives us some insight.
Yes, that's correct. So I'll entertain this idea here for a moment with this passage. One thing that we find in Ephesians 2 is that the Messiah's way of bringing about peace is through the shedding of blood, through the cross, and through death. This is interesting because all these things parallel the Roman imperial way of bringing about peace, although there's this sort of ironic parodying that I think is happening here in Ephesians 2, where in the Roman imperial way of bringing about peace, the shedding of the blood usually occurs with those to whom they're pacifying.
Okay, so
the enemies.
So let's just
the ones that they're trying to take over.
In contrast, so on the one hand, you have Rome bringing peace between potentially warring peoples or conflicted peoples by coming in and saying, we're going to do things this peaceful way now. And basically that means that we're going to crush any opposition.
Yeah, and that wasn't the only way of making peace in Rome. There were diplomatic ways of also making peace, but we're speaking now about the things that are parallel, I think, in the passage, or at least could be subtly assumed in the passage. And this is one potent way that Rome brought about peace, was shedding of blood of their enemies.
Of their enemies and to of pacify those that they them. Were, yeah, that they were subjugating. And then the contrast here is that there is shedding of blood in Ephesians 2, but the blood that is shed is that of the one who is doing the bringing of peace, right? So it's opposite.
Yeah, this is... It's opposite. And even in the Roman brand, the death that would sometimes also occur is of the leader of the opposition. So you get classic cases of peoples being subjugated. This goes even back into the first century BC, where Julius Caesar is conquering Gaul, and he takes the leader, Vercingetorix, and he throws him into jail, and then they execute him. So there's shedding of blood with the common people. I mean, the subjugation of Gaul from Julius Caesar, they think, may have led to 1 million deaths of Gallic people. So there's the shedding of blood of the people. There's also the shedding of blood of the leader. And what's so interesting is those concepts are invoked, I think, in some ways in Ephesians, but it isn't the transgressors whose blood are being shed. It is the one who's bringing about peace who's shedding blood for the transgressors. Mm-hmm. That is such a backwards way.
And shedding his own blood, right? His own blood is
shedding his own blood. Yes. For the transgressors. And it's such an interesting thing. The people who were once alienated, once far off, are actually brought near, not by the shedding of their blood or of their leaders, but by the one who's bringing peace, the one who's self-sacrificially. And then the cross plays a role in that too, where in Roman subjugation, the cross was a form of intimidation. I'm not meaning Jesus's cross, although that was, of course, the
executionary cross, right?
I'm just meaning crucifixion. Yeah. Yeah. So crucifixion functioned in the Roman brand of bringing about peace by signaling to subjugated peoples, if you challenge us, you'll end up like this, right? So in a lot of ways, we're seeing that the cross is again sort of reversed. It's not the means of intimidation. It's a means of self-sacrifice.
With Jesus.
Of Jesus's own blood. So you get these sort of almost parallel themes on how peace is brought about. But Ephesians seems to be projecting a very different kind of peace than what would have been the standard for the Roman Empire. And so I start to explore a little bit of what some of this would have meant for Ephesians 2, but also for its sort of imperial critical reading of the passage.
So this is super interesting, because I think at the locutionary level, probably the furthest you get toward an imperial critical reading would be to say there's this kind of overt mention of a different citizenship brought. And so at the locutionary level, that's there. But once you get into the illocutionary level and kind of this really interesting implied parity, it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
From an imperial critical perspective.
Yeah. And that's important because it raises some interesting questions about what we think about peace, you know, and even in the modern world. But I think that would have been something that was part of the intention of the speech acts for the original recipients, as well as for them to ponder and to consider the way within which peace is brought about to warring groups, and that it's not through bloodshed toward one another. It's through this sort of self-sacrificial love and actions of the Messiah, who is the only one who can bring such peace towards groups that are at enmity with one another.
Well, and I think that this is part of what's so interesting in the passage too. It's not just Jesus bringing peace between God and people who are in rebellion, but it's also, I mean, very much in this passage, bringing peace between peoples who are at enmity with each other.
Yeah.
And so this idea that he's not just giving up of himself so that people, kind of the classic, maybe evangelistic way that we think of it, of people who are far off being brought near to him, but also so that people who are not living at peace with each other can experience peace with one another.
Yeah. Yep, for sure. And one thing I want to bring into the conversation here briefly is to note that this is one of those instances where some of the speech act could change if the letter was written later. I engage a lot of questions on how the Augustine program, really the Julio-Claudians, and if you don't know what that is, that's the first Roman imperial family, how they projected certain ways of bringing about peace. But if this is written much later, then we would have to also take into consideration new projections of peace that are brought about by a new imperial family, while at the same time understanding that some of their projections of how peace was brought about was meant to reaffirm the sort of Augustine brand of it. So it wasn't so much to say, oh yeah, Augustus and those Julio-Claudians got this all wrong. We're doing peace in a total different way. It was in some ways to reiterate and to even reiterate, reinforce, and transcend some of the peace that had been offered by previous imperial families. So what it is, it's trying to say, look, when this was written can matter, because we might have to understand the sort of cognitive backdrop that the recipients are assumed to have in place could have some nuances to it that we haven't considered by just looking at like an Augustine era.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the passages in Ephesians that is kind of interesting and sometimes causes some consternation is Ephesians 5. 21 through 32?
Yeah, and it goes even further. It goes into some more aspects of a household code, which talks about the way that parents relate to children and that enslavers relate to those whom they enslave. And okay, so that's where it gets controversial.
But you specifically look just at 21 through 32.
Which is about marriage for the most part.
I've heard this preached a number of times at weddings. I think I may have preached on it once at a wedding. Sometimes there are wonderful sermons that can come out of this passage, and sometimes they're super cringy. So this is a really interesting one to look at with the question of Roman imperial criticism, right? This is that's not something I would have thought in this passage. And so I'm super curious what you do here.
Well, what did you preach? That's the question.
We can come to that later, I guess.
I honed in on one particular aspect of this passage that is often debated, and in order to actually also illustrate the method that I use, and since our listeners now will be familiar with the fact that what I've been trying to do all along is to try to move the conversation away from locutionary analysis, which is basically just saying, well, what do the words mean in this passage, and does it mean something Roman, does it mean something Jewish, and I'm trying to look at wider sort of narrative clashes that are occurring between the implied reader's context and the projections here in the passage. But the one thing I focus in on in Ephesians 5, 21 through 32 is the depiction of the head, the husband being the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. Mm-hmm. And this is often used to express the idea that this is the onus for women's submission within a marriage, and that the headship that's usually described here is a sort of top-down ruling headship where the husband is to make all the decisions, maybe even in a worst-case scenario, bark commands, and that the wife should just sort of acquiesce to the decisions of the husband.
Yeah, which is clearly missing what's happening in the later part of the passage.
Yes, however, here's what I'll say. So there's been so much, and this is where maybe some of our listeners will not have been caught up in the commentary's dispute about this, but so much has been made of what this word that we translate head really means. So that husband is the head of wife, Christ is the head. And there's been a lot of dispute about what that word means. It's a locutionary dilemma and dispute. Does head mean like hierarchical, top-down, authoritative position, or is it sort of the source from which the person stems from? It's all of this dispute has been part of the scholarly conversation. And what I say, and I use actually the work of Michelle Lee Barnwall here, and when she's written an article on this in Ephesians, where what I discovered was, I think I can confidently say that the word head, the Greek word for head here, kephale, does mean authoritative, top-down person. In fact, what's interesting is it's used that way in the Roman Empire. We see it happening under Nero's reign, where he is considered to be the head of the Roman people, where the people were expected to sacrifice themselves for the emperor because the destruction of the head or of the emperor would lead to the whole system of Roman peace collapsing. So what I do say is this, is if all we do is a locutionary analysis, what we'll discover is, uh-oh, and by uh-oh, I'm meaning those who don't want it to mean this. Uh-oh, it does in fact mean authoritative head. So for some, they will say, see, that reinforces the idea that the husband ought to be this in the marriage. Mm. What I say though about the passage, and this isn't many folks, even those who disagree on the question of to what extent women can participate in all of the same leadership roles in the church as men, even people on the different ends of those spectrum often will acknowledge that there is a reversal going on in this passage. So while the word itself, head, means a sort of authoritative person, the rest of the passage flips it by depicting the head not as, say, like Nero. Oh yeah, the husband is the head of the wife, like the emperor is the head of the Roman people. It doesn't say that. If it did, that sort of authoritative head would be reinforced. What it says is the husband's head of the wife, like Christ is the head of the church, who gives himself up for her, right? So you're getting this self-sacrificial depiction of headship, that while the word itself means authority, or essentially this authoritative head, there's a wink going on in the passage. Oh, yeah. Husband is head, kephale. But the kephale, like Christ, is the head, who isn't one who barks commands and authorities at the church in this passage, but one who self-sacrificially gives himself up.
And that, I think it's worth then in that same breath, remembering maybe the Philippians 2 explanation of just how thorough that giving of himself is.
Yeah. Yep, it's for sure.
It has to do with authority, right? It has to do with honor. It has to do with, you know, perceived rights, and then taking on the form of a servant and then giving himself up even to death. Right. So it's like, there's no let up in that, you know, it's that idea of just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, right. That giving himself up for her, it was so complete and thorough, right? Is really, really significant to understanding that it's not something that we should just gloss past and be like, oh yeah, he gave himself up for her. Like, no. This was like complete. And whatever the kenosis in Philippians 2 means, but
yeah. And I will say, you know, a friend of mine who's a New Testament scholar, Jenny Brown, did point out to me in a meeting we had here locally that this reading itself is actually embraced by both egalitarians and complementarians.
Yeah, so that's an important point.
People on the opposing spectrums of the issue of women in leadership roles in ministry. And I'm not actually trying to reinforce a complementarian view of this passage. But what I want to begin with is saying that some of the ways this passage has been depicted, because this is one of those places that Ephesians is dismissed in imperial critical discussions because of the passage. For a long time, this passage was read as accommodating the Roman Empire and the Roman imperial way of household structures.
So far from being perceived as a critique of the Roman Empire, it was perceived as being in agreement with or going along with furthering the Roman Empire. Is that right?
Yeah. And Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, who is a scholar far greater than I will ever be, suggests that this section is curiarchical, which she says is sort of expressing this top-down authoritative commands. Mm. And so she's troubled, I think, by the articulation that this passage is offering. And as great of a scholar as Schussler Fiorenza is, I disagree with her on this one, because I think that the passage is actually expressing less of a curiarchical type of top-down commanding. Curiarchical is coming from the Greek word kurios, which is lord, lording. Yeah. Yep, lordship and lording over. It's expressing this sort of like commandeering relationship between the husband and wife, which, you know, I know as a feminist scholar, at least Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza is very concerned with that depiction. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be dismissive of her points, because again, she's a far greater scholar than I probably will ever be. But I disagree with her conclusions on this, because I think there's some nuance happening in the passage that is often caught. Where I end up going with this, though, is by asking that question: does Ephesians' depiction of marriage especially lead to an accommodationist perspective of the Roman Empire, mm-hmm. or are there nuances going on in the passage that could see this as challenging, critical, or providing an alternative to that vision? So where I actually go with is by exploring Augustus's marriage legislations, which he put in place as part of his program of restoring the Roman Republic.
And roughly, for those who know, what year would this have been?
This would have been in the first century BC. So Augustus comes to power and technically comes to power in 29 BC, between 29 and 27, depending on what marker you're making. But he defeats Antony and Cleopatra in 31 BC, and then the empire begins to start to take shape. And in order, I think I've mentioned this in a previous episode of our podcast, but in order to be cautious to not depict himself in a king-like terms that Julius Caesar had been couched in, because it led to his assassination, Augustus is very savvy in ensuring that he is depicting his programs, we might say, as a restoration of the Republic. So one of the things that he does is to try to show that he is going back to Republican marriage ideals. Republican, not meaning American Republican, meaning the Roman Republic.
Right.
And so some of this was they outlawed adultery. They established various laws as it relates to encouraging Roman families and marriages. And so I put this passage within some of that backdrop and ask questions of whether or not it reinforces some of the Augustan ideals or potentially challenges it. And within it, I find some potential for a sort of what I call a Christological reshaping of these sort of ideals. And yet at the same time, recognizing that dependent upon the context that it was written in, it could have some different speech act meanings as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things I found really interesting in your chapter was you were talking about how clearly the author of this section was interacting with those household codes, But that also means that any departure from the household codes as they were kind of originally written is something really worth paying attention to.
Yeah, worth paying attention to, but we got to be cautious here, because I think this would be one of those moments where if you're into imperial critical interpretations of the New Testament, we could just start to read it everywhere.
Sure.
And what I caution against is saying this: the values expressed in Ephesians 5 of the relationship between husband and spouse are somewhat unprecedented in the Roman Empire. But what that it's difficult to then say
and this is because of the giving up of oneself for the others. Okay,
correct. Yeah, but what's difficult now then to say is this challenging Roman imperial marital ideals, or is it challenging wider sort of cultural mores that are less linked to Roman imperial ideology? And again, those two are difficult to segregate. We can't necessarily say that the challenging of the one is inherently also the challenging of the other. So what I want to caution against is there's many ways that this passage could be seen as sort of, for lack of better words, countercultural in some of its marital ideals, but countercultural doesn't necessarily mean anti-imperial. So we've got to be a little cautious. There's room to say this could be challenging imperial marital ideals, but there's also room to say it could be challenging wider sort of cultural mores. Mm. So I want to be cautious in drawing too much from it, except to say what I think it is not is inherently accommodationist perspective on Roman marriage that is intended to sort of squash any potential way that the Roman Empire might be suspicious of Christian communities. And so they're just sort of apologetically trying to show, no, we fit in with Roman society. It's more complicated than that, is what I end up concluding.
Yeah,
so accommodationist, not exactly challenging Roman Empire. It depends. I'd be a little cautious, so to say that's definitely what's going on there, but it's an opportunity to try to show how this can be brought into the conversation.
I think that's helpful because on the one hand, you're looking at this and saying, you know, maybe it's there, and you're looking at it and saying, well, yeah, maybe it's there and maybe it's not completely there. But you have this kind of nuanced take on it, which I guess we'd expect in a, you know, hopefully defined in a dissertation. I want to read a section here that maybe brings together the first part of what you were saying.
Sure.
By tracing, so these are your words again. By tracing imperial conceptions of the Roman emperor, especially Nero, as head, we can see that the subjects of the Roman Empire were expected to sacrifice themselves for the emperor, since the destruction of the head would lead to the destruction of the Roman peace, which you mentioned earlier. In a context where the conception of headship was normal, the husband's call to self-sacrificial messiah-like love for his wife in Ephesians 5 could have been understood to undermine traditional Roman imperial marriage ideals, especially since family units were supposed to reflect the imperial order of society. So that would be kind of the strong statement, right? If this is Roman imperial critical, that's where we find it. But then you also kind of back off from that and say, you know, it may or may not be. Either way, it provides a really interesting look at, you know, what is this passage doing and kind of the ways that we often interpret it, you know, as far as relationships between husbands and wives. But yeah, definitely. Interesting here. So then you go on and say, in many ways, this section of Ephesians reverses imperial conceptions of the function of marriage in the Roman world. However, its imperial critical thrust is largely dependent on the extent to which it can be shown that its counter ideology specifically challenges the ethos of Augustine or wider imperial marital policies, since these policies are directly derived from imperial ideology rather than merely general cultural mores.
Yeah,
I think that's here's what's interesting to try to bring this again into our context. I want to be a little careful here because I'm not trying to get like super political with it, but clearly the passage is political. And so, you know, if we're bringing it into our contemporary context, you know, I don't know if we can help that.
Or to transfer the ancient world, everything's political. Everything's political. Everything's religious. So, I mean, but you know what I mean is that segregation of the political from the religious is not so simple in the ancient world. And maybe even not in the modern world as much as we like to presume it is.
And that's part of what I'm thinking. I'm thinking in contemporary American society, right? So we're recording this a few days after the overturning of Roe v. Wade. There are questions that came up immediately about, you know, whether the approach that was taken there would be extended to other Supreme Court decisions from the past. And I think that you could critique, I think, you know, if somebody today wanted to critique the American Republican Party, you know, as it currently is, they could make statements about, you know, abortion or whether that's about same-sex marriage. Like, you could critique the Republican Party without naming the Republican Party by critiquing the position. And so it's possible that that's what's happening. And you could do the same thing, of course, with the Democratic Party, right? You could, you know, critique Democrats without naming Democrats by just critiquing their position on core, well-known issues, right? I think that you talked before about how, in some ways, the program that Augustus was involved with here was kind of like a make Rome great again, kind of an approach. And so we can see parallels today where you can make critiques based on policy, make critiques of the people in leadership without ever naming them. And I think, is that right? That's kind of the question here, where you're saying here's this household code of ethics, which on the one hand seems completely non-political, but when we look at our own context and how we deal with household code of ethics and how that is brought into law, we see that it's immediately political in our context.
Yeah, and it also gets so complicated because it's not always easy to discern whether or not they're just conflicting ideologies that are existing in the same sphere, or whether or not that the expression of the one ideology is intended to specifically critique the other. Mm. And sometimes it's difficult to discern. Other times it's a little more obvious. Sometimes it matters on to whom the speech act is being spoken, right? So if you're speaking to a bunch of people that agree with your ideology, you may be implicitly critiquing the other side, for lack of better terms, or you may be intending to reinforce the ideology among your own, which isn't really so much then about critique as much as it is about the sort of in-group thinking or something. But then all of a sudden, if you're saying the same exact locutions, but you're gearing it towards a relative that thinks completely opposite from you, it may not be a sense of reinforcement. It most certainly might be intended as a critique and even as a convincing. And then there's other interesting times where critique is intended, but absolutely no convincing is intended because they're kind of seen as a lost cause or something. Mm. So understanding what's going on in a speech act or speech acts in various contexts to various people is very complicated. And I think what my project raises the question of is could some of these conflicts have been more intentional and have been doing subversive like speech acts in ways that have not been acknowledged? Well, at the same time, I don't want to suggest that it's the only possible speech act that could be in view. There's speech acts are complicated, but I also want to center on what we know about the implied audience and how if spoken into a specific environment, it can change the meanings of the speech acts, just like the difference between talking, you know, politics with a friend who agrees with you or talking with a relative who blatantly disagrees with you.
So it sounds like part of what you're saying is like, if there's a critique of the Roman Empire here in Ephesians 5, it doesn't mean that the plain reading of Ephesians 5 is not also intended.
Yeah, and that's where it gets even more complicated when it talks about the interpretation of text, or even specifically the interpretation of
the plain reading by the Bible is also.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I would use that term, the plain reading. What I would instead raise is
locutionary reading. Would that be a?
Yeah, and I think I think some people would say plain, some people would say literal, some people might say locutionary, but even that locutions don't exist in their own, right? In fact, that one thing Austin pointed out early on is that that all locutions have illocutionary intent, so you can't divorce the two.
So it'd be more of the entirely. Layers of of illocutions.
That's the question. And so what I conclude at the very, very end of my project here is something that's dancing on, maybe we might say, some murky territory. And that's where I suggest that it's possible that there are these, at times, anti-imperial flares present in the text, intended to be understood by the implied readers, while at the same time not necessarily diminishing some of the other speech act expressions that are occurring in the text that are some of the more, maybe for lack of better words, traditional under ways of traditional ways of understanding the text. So what I say is that to read it in the way that I'm proposing doesn't mean that all of a sudden every other purpose that we've ever discerned from Ephesians is now out the window.
Right.
So this is where we get to this complexity of speech acts carrying either multiple meanings or nuances of meanings, or some speech acts in Ephesians maybe having anti-imperial flares, others not, others having other intents and intentions. And that's where it requires us to read it as a whole. It requires us to read it carefully. And so I do uphold the idea that we could still think parts of Ephesians may have these anti-imperial flares to it, while at the same time, some of the other purposes that have been discerned from Ephesians can still be held to be true. Mm. They don't have to conflict, and they can be supplementary. What I mean by that is things like identity formation for these Christian communities, right, which can be both it challenging empire times and other times not, and other times not even related to that whatsoever. So there are all sorts of strategies of what Ephesians could be doing to its audience that challenging empire is only one of those possibilities.
This concludes our second conversation in the final series about Justin's dissertation concerning imperial critical readings of Ephesians. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.